You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I have often walked down this street before.
Hey! What's the matter? I'm walking here! I'm walking here!
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Now, I'm not bitter.
We're taking the show to the street today.
He's got to be strong.
We'll linger on the corner with some musicians and catch up with a pair of graffiti artists showing their kids some of the subtle design elements in their work.
My name's there. My name's right there.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
How come?
I feel famous.
Movies can make us yearn for the street, give us tastes of its mystery and its life.
Morning, Walter!
To help us explore the movies and music and painting and people that put life in the streets is my guest Joel Meyerowitz. Joel is probably best known for his gorgeous beach photographs collected in his book called Cape Light, but he's also the co-author of a book called Bystander, A History of Street Photography. One of the pictures that caught my eye in Bystander is called The Artist Lives Dangerously. John Gutman took the picture in San Francisco in 1938. Defined by crisp sunlight and the short shadows of midday, a boy kneels in the asphalt street. He's absorbed in his chalk drawing of the feathered headband of an Indian, just as a hulking car zooms by. Literally, art on the street by any means necessary. Joel Meyerowitz, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. Great to be here.
Now, in your book, Bystander, why did you choose the pictures you choose, and particularly, if we can start with the one I mentioned, the one from San Francisco in 1938 called The Artist Lives Dangerously?
Well, if I could just go back a moment to the initiating idea, you know, not everybody can work on the street. It takes a particular mentality, a sense of humor, a risky, chance-taking mindset that the street will provide opportunities that you could not conceive of in the studio or in a controlled situation.
Because they just come up on the fly and you have to take advantage.
Exactly. And it requires a kind of stance in the world, an acceptance of your open-endedness so that things in the world could give you the gift of your insight. And so I started looking at these pictures, and I had this idea that street photography, although accepted and under the rubric of documentary photography or photojournalism, actually is the center and the source of photography's energies. Because all else in photography relates in some ways to painting. The still life, the portrait, all of these things have even the landscape has a relationship to the history of painting. But street photography, when it was born, influenced a whole generation of Impressionist painters. It made them break the frame in a way. It made them or allowed them to see street life in a fresh sort of a nimbus of possibilities.
And it was a thing that until that time painters really hadn't done. And it was a thing that from the beginning photography could do uniquely as its own part of the artistic panorama.
Absolutely. Even with the limitations that photography had 150 years ago, there were still people who risked making the picture with a motion blur in it or the edges cut off. And for me, one of the important qualities of that was that painting before that was contained in the frame. You almost never saw something half in and half out. Photography dealt with those fragmentary moments in which something was leaving and something was coming on. It talked about the world outside the frame. So John Gutman's picture has about it the wit, whimsy, timing, improbability of all the best of street photography. That boy drawing on the street, the gesture of his body, the entrance of this huge vehicle. You almost can't know in the instant that these things appear, they're actually disappearing. And a photograph made at 250th of a second or a thousandth of a second slices this sliver. But in that sliver is the capacity for we human beings to have a perception. I think it's how we survived as a species, is that you could feel on the flicker of your peripheral vision that arrow, that spear, that rock coming at you, and maybe it allowed you the moment of survival. And I think photographers who use small cameras and work on the street bring to it that kind of capacity for sensing all in the environment and recognizing the potential of meaning.
When you were starting out a few decades ago in photography, did you know this is the kind of work you wanted to do?
Oddly enough, when I started, which was 1962, I had no idea of anything about photography. But when I saw Robert Frank make some photographs on a job, I was an art director, and he was shooting some girls in Stuyvesant Town over here, and I had to go and watch him do this. I knew nothing about Robert Frank, but he was such a wisp of a figure moving like smoke in front of these girls, and they paid no attention to him. He became invisible. And all I could think of was, I'm going to go get a camera and I'm going to go out on the street. I want to do that on the street.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz today. Joel, you grew up in New York City?
I did. I'm a Bronx boy.
Well, the Bronx Charter School for the Arts is a new elementary school built around the idea that arts education is crucial to all education. And when the school opened this past fall, we sent reporter Alicia Zuckerman to check it out. Since then, she's been visiting Bronx Arts all year and met two students whose relationship to the arts is rooted in the surrounding streets, streets which turned their fathers into artists almost 25 years ago.
Actually, the pewter gray would be good for the highlight on the end. And then shape up there, look, you see where it's not round, huh?
We're going to do that with baby blue. I got it in my pocket.
Wilfredo Feliciano and Sotero Ortiz go by Bio and BG183, or just BG. They're part of a group called Tat's Crew. Tat stands for Top Artistic Talent. They met in high school in the South Bronx 23 years ago, and they've been painting together ever since. When they were teenagers, they painted graffiti on city walls and subway trains. They had to work fast to get away unnoticed, and when they didn't, they ran from the cops. Their work is different now. Their style is the same, but now they get paid for this, and paid well, by clients like Tommy Hilfiger, Coca-Cola, and M&M Candies.
The murals can range anywhere from a few hundred dollars to several thousand dollars. It depends on the project and the client. But this is easy money, you know? Quick, simple artwork.
Nice day.
Can't beat it.
They move their spray cans in quick, graceful sweeps like dancers. Occasionally, Bio takes a bite of a sandwich with one hand, continuing to paint with the other. He's been doing it for so long, it's second nature. When they're done, the words mucho más color, Spanish for much more color, are splashed in bright, jagged letters across a giant blue M&M.
A job well done again. 2 hours. Getting slow in our age.
Bio and BG became artists on the gritty streets of the 1980s South Bronx. A couple of decades later, their kids are learning about art in the same neighborhood, but in a very different way.
We call it, what do we call it?
The elephant note.
We call the whole note the elephant note.
Bio's 8-year-old son Aaron and BG's 7-year-old daughter Dawn both go to the Bronx Charter School for the Arts, an elementary school that opened this year right in the middle of their dad's old stomping ground. They take 8 arts classes every week, and music, dance, and theater play a role in their academic classes, too. Aaron and Dawn love it.
Daddy, I need a straw.
A straw? Oh, for your juice.
Most days after school, they stop by the community center where Tat's Crew, Inc. has its office.
Oh, cool. Who drew this?
I did.
Oh, nice. What is it supposed to be?
A bird with the linear puzzle.
Okay. Looks good. I like it. Probably color it later when we get home, right?
Yeah.
I don't try to teach her graffiti. I ain't trying to teach her art. She just came about just learning by herself. And every day I come home, She always showing me, like, hey, this is what I did in school. You know, this is what I'm drawing.
I pull, like, one or two. I don't really throw it out.
My name's there. My name's right there. Aaron.
Oh, yeah.
And you saw my name.
Graffiti artists tend to have something of an obsession with painting their own names. And when their kids were born, Bio and BG began painting their kids' names, too.
Do you like that?
Yeah.
How come?
I feel famous.
Driving around this neighborhood where they still live and work, with the kids in the back seat, Bio and BG stop in front of one of their personal projects, an intricate anti-war mural.
And, you know, this was our way of speaking out. You know, in the middle you have like a demonstration of people demonstrating against the war, where you have police and riot helmets sort of fighting the crowd. And then all around is this imagery of, you know, bombs, barbed wire, battlefield fire.
And directly across the street, on the side of a bodega, is one of their promotional pieces for Willy Wonka candy.
I like that one because they're saying stop the war, and I like that one because I like candy.
Tatscrew's artwork is legendary in their neighborhood, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's sacred. They pull up in front of a mural they recently painted in the schoolyard of their old high school.
Look at this. Some kids are drawn, like, little pictures.
Dawn and Aaron lean in to peer at it, and they're outraged that someone has scrawled graffiti on it.
It messes up my dad's beautiful artwork. Yeah, that's not right.
Bio and BG are kind of annoyed, too. But, Bio says, stuff like this, what most people think of as vandalism, is actually an important part of becoming a graffiti artist. It's how they started. Tonight, Tatscrew is showing some of their work at a gallery in Chelsea, one of Manhattan's hottest art scenes. Explosions of color painted to look three-dimensional pulse from the canvases, images just like Bio used to paint on the subway trains.
I mean, watching my son grow up, I mean, it's definitely going to be different for him. I mean, he's going to experience a different way. I think he's grown up around it. You know, he sees it in the house. He sees my pictures. He just, I mean, I don't know how he interprets it, but I mean, whatever. I mean, it's just I want to expose him to it. I want him to know that what's out there. I want him to know that it's a big world exists out there.
That's what BG wants for Dawn, too. He still misses tagging up walls in the middle of the night, but he's also proud of getting up early every day, working hard and making a good living doing what he loves. And he's obviously proud of his daughter, who wants to be an artist.
And at the same time, she wants to be a police officer. I want to be a police officer, but yet she draws. Maybe she get a job, maybe doing like those wanted posters. And that would be great, you know. It's wonderful. And I save everything she draws, you know. Maybe she become a great artist later on. You know, she got open doors. You know, I'm definitely going to help her out. So I'm the first guy that, yeah, no worry, I'm your agent. We're going to make money together.
Bio and BG are passing their own love of the arts onto their kids, but neither wants to see them follow exactly in their footsteps. Bio says he's not sure what he would do if Aaron started illegally writing graffiti.
I don't know. I think I have a nervous breakdown like every other parent, you know? Well, I guess I would explain to him. I mean, I've been through it, so I guess I would share my experiences with him and try to guide him, you know, the right way and how to do it and not to get in trouble. But, you know, like every other kid, I guess they'll learn their own way.
With that, Bio goes back to the crowd, a long way from the subway tunnels of the South Bronx.
Thank you for coming down.
For Studio 360, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we're talking about the culture and art of the street. Joel, when you were young, obviously in the Bronx, there was, the only graffiti was the occasional piece of artless vandalism, I expect.
We drew in chalk on the streets, you know. That was our blackboard. And we had, you know, ample room and time to do it, but we never defaced public property in that sense. And so when graffiti exploded in New York, I wasn't a big fan, you know. I saw it in a sense as vandalism. And not that I couldn't appreciate some of the craft. I mean, as a kid, I did bubble letters and shadowing letters and, you know, Superman letters. And it was part of, you know, the way you doodle and scribble. You know, so I'm vacillating here because at the same time it's a sort of folk art from the ghetto, and it allows people to learn to use space and color. And I love when he said, I got the pewter gray, I got the blue in my pocket. I mean, I thought, yeah. I mean, they're seeing the color.
Well, it was also great to see the children notice that their father's graffiti had been vandalized by somebody else, which, you know, it was a funny moment about whose ox is being gored and what is defined as a criminal assault. No, I am ambivalent in the same way that you are. It is an interesting example, though, of what happens a lot, has happened a lot in the last 40 years of things beginning on the street, literally or figuratively, and bubbling up into the mainstream. You see it, obviously, in fashion all the time, and the sort of skateboard culture today, and hip-hop, too. And actually, it occurred to me that when they were talking about the fact that so much of graffiti is about painting words, more than analogously, it seems to me, the great kind of inspiration and radical difference of hip-hop is that it's about words, in a way, that pop music, at least, you know, since Cole Porter, hadn't so much been.
Mm-hmm. It evolved. It appeared because it took the barricades in a way. And we had to, in a sense, or the administrations of that era had to confront them and say, no, you know. First, they confronted them by making surfaces that you couldn't paint on or it could clean more easily, right? Those stainless steel trains and the like. And the graffiti artists found a way around it. They scratched or sprayed. But I think it forced a dialogue between the art world in its more static way and this non-art world that was erupting with color and scale and lettering and all this energy. And in a way, you create a new vocabulary in the time there. And it starts off as ugly, and then it achieves some kind of beauty in all art. Since, you know, I guess forever.
Certainly for the last 150 or so years, yeah.
Yeah, it insults and then it elbows its way in through its rudeness in a way. And wonderful things come out of it. That his daughter is going home and drawing. You know, he's planted a seed in some way. I loved that. I thought that was so tender, you know, because you never know where you're going to get your instinct from.
Joel Meyerowitz is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, how the street inspires all kinds of art, including movies. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Volkswagen of America and the Phaeton, a new kind of luxury car from Volkswagen. More information about the Phaeton's all-wheel drive system or its 335-horsepower V8 engine can be found at VW.com. And by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. Funding for Studio 360 is provided by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Roots by the Gypsy Kings, the French group's first acoustic album in over a decade, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is the photographer Joel Meyerowitz. And today we're talking about how the street inspires all kinds of art, including movies.
I'm singing in the rain.
Gene Kelly's famous dance in Singing in the Rain is probably the Hollywood backlot version of the city street. But there are all kinds of ways that the street gets portrayed by filmmakers. Sometimes a cityscape turns into much more than just a scenic backdrop. Sarah Lilly explains.
Have you ever seen a street that you actually know depicted in a film? It's a feeling that sort of tickles you in the gut, all that celluloid magic brought to bear on a place you've actually been to. When the film Rocky came out, I was a sixth grader in Philadelphia, and I couldn't believe my eyes. My hometown on the big screen, it was so exciting.
The number one heavyweight of the world!
But some directors are able to create that sense of meaning and familiarity using street settings that may not literally be ones we know. Directors do it by giving the street a role in the drama.
My idea of how the street is used in most movies is a way of portraying what a neighborhood is.
New York Press film critic Armand White.
The film that makes me think most often about what streets mean in movies is a Tom Hanks film from the 90s called The Burbs, which actually is a film about a neighborhood, a film about a cul-de-sac, which is a particular kind of street that really does define a neighborhood, that really does define an enclave.
Morning, Walter!
And The Burbs, which is directed by Joe Dante, is a very interesting film about how people on a street in a certain confined neighborhood understand themselves, understand their social relationships with their neighbors.
That old fart. He's got the best lawn on the block. And you know why? Because he trains his dog to crap in my yard.
If a cul-de-sac is all about trying to achieve safety and quiet, it's pretty different than the streets most people think of.
Well, one film that depicts the city through the presentation of a street and does it very strongly for me is The Godfather Part II. Especially in the sequence where young Vito Corleone walks down the street and he's gaining his reputation as a powerful, if shady, character. And as he walks down the street, the different merchants and people on the street look at him and approach him in a particular way.
Desidero un po' di frutta, tutto fresco, frutta da giornata.
The director Coppola returns to that street very frequently throughout the film, so that street becomes a character in a sense.
No, no, è mio piacere, niente sordo, è un regalo questo.
That's probably the very best depiction in a Hollywood movie of what the Lower East Side of New York was like at the beginning of the 20th century. A very strong visual evocation of that era and what a street was in America for some of the first immigrants.
The street is about jostling side by side with the people you like and the people you don't. It's where you can't always pick and choose, where accidents or magic can occur because the nature of the street is that you have to share it with others. There's a film from the 40s that depicts this most poetically.
I think one of the most famous street films is in fact a short that was made during the 1940s, an Academy Award-winning short called The House I Live In, which featured Frank Sinatra singing the song The House I Live In.
The house I live in, a plot of earth, a street. The grocer and the butcher and the people that I meet.
It's all about Frank Sinatra portraying a character who sings about the block that he lives on. And what you have in this short film is the depiction of an urban American street.
All races and religions.
It's all about the diversity of America, because the house I live in is a metaphor for America. But the film, the short film, very interestingly depicts America as a street. As a block where different people come together and live out their lives, where different people become America.
That's America to me.
When you have a film where the drama is situated on a street, those kinds of films tend to be about community. Those kind of films tend to be about people finding out where they belong, or at least discovering something about the place where they belong.
So when Rocky makes his triumphant ascent up the steps of the Philadelphia Museum, looks out over that commanding view of the city and throws up his arms, everyone in Philadelphia is there in spirit with him, proudly thinking, that's my town. That's where I come from.
The number one heavyweight of the world. Like the guy said, you're gonna eat lightning and you're gonna crap thunder.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we are talking about the street. As I was listening to those bits of music and clips from those films, I realized how much, in many cases, one's or my cinematic experience of streets then goes back and influences my real experience of streets. I mean, I can't walk around New York without all of the movies about New York that I've seen essentially distorting or shaping how I experience the real streets.
I'm agreeing with you on that. I certainly carry you know, many films in my head for the flavor or the romance of New York streets. I mean, I walk them every day myself, and I know their hardness and their density. But my leanings towards the street actually go towards Fellini, because what he proposed about street life was that we get glimpses. If you think of his frames, he charges his frames filled with people, the most incredible types, but he doesn't let them linger on screen for very long. You get a breathless, brief glimpse of them, and then they're whisked away, and you're left hungering for them. And to me, that's the street. You can fall in love on a New York City street, you know, 10 times an hour because someone turns a corner and you might see a leg coming out of a skirt or the edge of a profile or the glint of someone's hair, or maybe it's the shine on someone's lipstick. I'm taking it from the male point of view here. But, I mean, those little things could break your heart in a split second. And it's part of the richness of city life is that it's constantly churning more and more information like this, and it's eroticizing ordinary life.
As you walk down the streets in Rochester, New York, where you just were, or New York, or Florence, or wherever, presumably you have a camera with you all the time.
I do.
That must alter your experience of the street, because you're always waiting to catch an image, are you not?
I am. I think of it as my license to see. I've got this camera, and it's always cocked and ready, and set for a reach of somewhere around 10 feet. And so I'm constantly sifting the space that I walk through. And it's not that I'm searching for a photograph. I'm trying to stay conscious. I'm watching the world as it keeps on synchronizing itself to my pace in a way. I move fast and the world seems to open up. I move slowly and dawdle and everything, and the world kind of gets lazy in front of me. And I just look at it. And if I can do that in an open-minded way, things will make themselves known. And I'll see strange combinations. And often there's a sort of accompaniment, a verbal accompaniment I keep to the street. I say to myself, oh, look at that. I mean, look at the way that guy's carrying that huge sheet of glass. And, oh, my God, here comes a kid on a bicycle. And if you see that
stuff. You say those things out loud?
I say it in my mind.
Oh.
You know, I'm weaving the layers of what's happening in front of me into a kind of braid of consciousness so that I'll begin to suddenly say, oh, wait a second, that is interesting to me. Those two things are happening simultaneously. See, I think if I can just carry this thought for a second. It's not that an object appears on the street. It's the multiplicity of lives happening in front of you. And if you begin to stitch them together by just zoning across the space, and you see that they're actually happening at the same time, they're in a frame, which you then raise to your eye and put around these things. And you gather this energy in. And its meaninglessness in the general moment of life can be concentrated by the frame's cutting, and perhaps you will get a new kind of tinder and flint making the spark of meaning. And it's that play of the poetics of possibility or the humor or even the ambiguity of life.
Well, and it also, as I heard you describing so beautifully how a great photograph of the street can work, it reminds me of how collages work and the degree to which urban life, street life, is the kind of collage experience of these people that don't belong together and these different buildings that don't belong together and these signs and all this stuff. But if, you know, in the blink of an eye or, in your case, an aperture, I guess, you can make it have you can connect those dots.
That's beautiful, Kurt. The collage idea of it is, I mean, collage is particularly a modern art form. It's the ripping out of things from the whole and then putting them down in a new assemblage. And what is photography? Photography rips a piece of time out of the whole that's floating by. It is purely modernist thinking.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson with photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we are talking about the street. The streets of Southwest Chicago, with smokestacks and factories looming in the background, provide the setting for Stuart Dybeck's writing. Dybeck grew up in the neighborhoods known as Little Village and Pilsen. He wrote an award-winning collection of reminiscences called Childhood and Other Neighborhoods. He's now working on a book of poems called Streets in Their Own Ink. We asked him to read a poem from that collection and tell us what inspired it.
We're on Rockwell, right across from what used to be a factory called 3V's Birdseed. And Rockwell is a, as you can see, is a street of factories and rusted cyclone fences and warehouses. And it was a street, when I was growing up, and probably still is for that matter, that attracted kids at night. They drag raced down the street and did all kinds of mischief. But it was also a street that gang fights would occur on. And in a story called Blue Boy that I wrote on this street, a kid who's in that story is named Tony Bizarro, Peanuts Bizarro, is killed. He's shot while boxing behind a cyclone fence with a kid from another gang. And what actually happened is he climbed back over the fence and tried to get home with the gang of us walking behind him, stunned, not knowing what to do. And he fell down repeatedly and he left a trail of blood. And it's just one of those images that I don't think it has to be explained why. It's the kind of thing somebody would remember for a good long time afterwards. So it appears in my fiction and poetry, and the poem Boundary, in a way, is a poem kind of written about that experience. And in fact, the police did come and draw the traditional chalk circle around the body and so on and so forth. And so whenever we walked down the street, it was like a little alcove for an icon. You would, no matter what you were doing, you would suddenly remember that this is where that particular kid had fallen. Boundary. It traces the irregularities of pavement, fills cracks, floods the gaps, planned for expansion in the heat, eddies into a sticky ring beneath a pop bottle before pooling in the gutter, the way an eye socket pools, until every aspect of the street is soaked in a stretch of shade noon can erase, wine dark, a birthmark the chalked outline of a body can't contain. It fades as it flowed, gradually, but in summer's bleaching brightness, beneath a shrill of blackbirds, children moving to the beat of an outraged boombox they shoulder, drop their voices as they pass through the shadow, and the basketball trotting beside them balks at the border of the stain.
That's the poet Stuart Dybeck reading his poem Boundary. I'm Kurt Anderson with Joel Meyerowitz, and we're talking about the street. It's interesting in that poem, which is a short poem, they're obviously talking about a scene of a crime and an assault and a bloodstain, but you don't, the punchline until the last line, you don't find it's a bloodstain. Which again, as I heard that poem and thought of it as a photograph, I thought the way one's eye scans a picture for the first time and find the details, and sometimes you don't really see the whoa punchline in a visual sense until the end in the same way. Do you construct images to have that same kind of reveal, or can you not plan the way people look at pictures?
You can't plan the way people look at pictures. I was just going to say that. In fact, that as the poem was read, I was channeling Ouija. You know, there it was. I mean, this that's what I was getting from
that famous Ouija picture of a body, corpse on the street.
Yeah, and the newsiness of it, and the way the crowd is behind Ouija. You don't see the crowd, but you know the crowd is there, glomming the whole thing. But one of the joys of photography, and probably a real pain to some other photographers, but not to me in this case, is that literature, you start in the upper left-hand corner, you follow the line left to right. Photography, the frame is wide open. You can start in the center on the lower right-hand corner. You can move zigzag all over it, reading the content, because it's fluid in there. Even though it's static, it's fluid. It's one of those oxymorons of photography. And it's part of what I like, because you can't really tuck something away. You make the picture, and all the information is presented at once. It's instantaneous revelation, basically, or description. Maybe we can say it that way. But in the best reads of interesting photographs, maybe even not interesting photographs, but evidentiary photographs, you often draw things out of them that are richly described and filled with possible meanings. So, and that poem evoked that, I thought.
That poem gives such a vivid, visceral feeling of the actual physical sensation of the street. The street, as a kind of trope or as a metaphor or as a symbol, is not all nice. In fact, it's mostly not nice, is it?
No, it's edgy and dangerous and filled with unknowns and surprises. It just depends on your take on it. If you're a native New Yorker who loves the street, then you bathe in it. I mean, I love it in the heat of the summer when it's tropical and steamy and sexy, and all the undertones of violence are there in the city. I feel like I got my skin on. But somebody else might come to that who's not in the tempo of a big city street life, and they might feel it's danger. And the thrill that I feel is to them something that is darker or menacing.
Well, the street is, I think, today is a more distinct arena in our whole realm of experience than it was 30 or 40 years ago, because inside has become so thoroughly air-conditioned. I know this sounds stupid, maybe, but I think, especially in the summer, the street, you can do a lot of things to it, but unless you turn it into a mall, it's hot. It's full of nature and the smells and feelings of nature. And I think it becomes, as we kind of climate control the rest of life, a more kind of primal place that it wasn't when we were young.
It's a great observation, because we certainly are controlling our inner spaces in a more modified way, and people will seek that kind of shelter. And I often go to cities in the south of the United States and find them incredibly empty. Walk along in Atlanta in the spring and summer, there's nobody on the street. Or you go to Texas, in some of these big towns in Texas, no one walks. They drive everywhere, air-conditioned cars. They park underneath the buildings, and the downtowns are dead, And it's because of all that air conditioning.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I think the effect of air conditioning on America's cities and streets can't be overstated. And yet, of course, you go to a mall, and you see, in their way, sometimes more or less successfully, sometimes disastrously, they are trying to recreate the street, the main street, the town street, the city street. Do they ever do it, in your view?
Not for me, they don't. They're sterilized, preconceived. They're precast, I say, give me Swelter. I'll be out in it.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we are talking about pictures and art and poetry and music in the streets. In Cape Town, South Africa, if you wander outside the main train station, this is what you'll hear. In the middle of the day, the vendors who sell things near the station gather under the shade of a tree and play this music together. They're not singing for money, it's just what they do every day during their break. In a minute, we'll hear from a very different kind of street performance in this country. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for Studio 360 is provided by The Economist, featuring weekly book reviews and global arts coverage on newsstands and on the web at economist.com/books. And by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Roots by the Gypsy Kings, the French group's first acoustic album in over a decade, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
Yeah. Jesus, I'm singing this song.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we are talking about The Street. Right now, you're hearing the guitarist and singer Bill McCoola, who plays at the corner of Center Street and Martin Luther King Boulevard in Berkeley, California.
Thank you, my man.
Joel Meyerowitz, do you enjoy the presence of street music and street musicians?
I do, actually. I mean, it started for me way back in the 60s when Moondog used to stand on 6th Avenue and 53rd Street. And I used to hang out with him there on my lunch hour. And
now, he's the legendary guy that Janis Joplin sang about, right?
Right, exactly. But, I mean, he was a character, a monstrous character with a great big Nordic helmet on his head with horns and everything. And fascinating bearded creature. And so he was just character for me. And just this morning, after I returned from Rochester, I went through Central Park for 15 minutes to kind of clear my head. And I walked underneath a little bridge, and there was a guy with a tenor sax all by himself, wearing sandals and a T-shirt. It was cold under the bridge, too. And he was blowing so sweetly. He had such a voice. And I stood there, and I just was transported by him. And I thought, well, it's a gift, you know?
Our next story is about a very different kind of street performance from those that we've just talked about. Damali Ayo is a conceptual artist, and she's been doing an ongoing street performance called Living Flag that she takes to busy corners in cities all over the country. You might find her one day on a street in your hometown.
It's kind of a do-it-yourself approach. You guys want to pay some reparations today? You want to pay some reparations?
I'm assuming slavery of some sort.
Do you have anything to explain slavery?
I have to explain slavery?
It's a payment for the work of my great-great-grandfather who was enslaved by people related to you. I'll write your receipt.
Panhandling is a vulnerable and risky act. When I see a panhandler, I wonder, what is it like to realize it has come to this? To place your body on a street corner and ask for money. When I think of the issue of reparations for slavery in this country, I think black people are in a similar position to the panhandler. It has come to this. Every time I see a black person living on the street, I think about slavery. I think about a country where so many black people are on the street, in poverty, and in prison. I think about reparations.
I'm a little not ready. Just got myself a nice hot tea, and I'm going to look for a spot to sit.
I look for a spot with a lot of foot traffic. I give money to other panhandlers and make sure I don't interfere with their work.
I do not know where to sit. I don't see any other panhandlers. Big American flag ahead. I should probably sit right over that.
Sometimes I tape an American flag over my mouth. I become a living flag, staking my claim to this country.
I don't know if I have this in me right now.
I sit down, get out my can.
All right, I can do this.
I wear a sign around my neck that says, 200 plus years of slavery in the United States. I place a sign in front of my can that says, reparations accepted here.
Pay some reparations today? Very simple. I'll write you a receipt. Oh, thank you. Would you like a receipt?
I don't need a receipt. Thank you.
Okay. You have a good day.
So far, I've panhandled in Portland, Chicago, New York, and Boston.
Would you guys like to pay some reparations today?
A body on the street is not invisible. But there's a moment when we choose to honor or ignore that person. We look past people on the street, much as we ignore and dismiss aspects of history. When I panhandle for reparations, every person who passes me gets the chance to honor or ignore that history.
So $5, William. William.
I don't, okay, I see what you're doing.
Yeah, this, you can send this to the IRS and you can write it off on your taxes.
Okay, well, by God.
$5 on donation. October 29th.
Many black people I met while panhandling told me they have given up on the idea of reparations. Few believe that white people would even admit that they benefit from slavery.
I think it's a foregone concept that'll never come to fruition. I don't know how much difference it would actually make. I think it would be more of a gesture of goodwill, but I think just for your mental state, I think that would make a difference to African Americans that the government acknowledged it and is trying to do something. I think that would make a difference.
And cash?
There you go.
Thanks. Would you like a receipt?
Sure.
Okay. Did you give me 20 cents?
I, being an American, unfortunately have to admit that we are still a racist country, and we know that minorities do not get a fair shake in this country, and it's time that we did something about it. And the blacks always get the short end of the stick, so I'm all for reparations.
How are you doing?
How are you doing?
Good. You know about reparations?
Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I think it's good, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Really? Here. I'll make it happen for you right now.
No,
I'm paying black people for their reparations. Some white person gave this to me, so I'm giving it to you. So today I gave away $3 to other African Americans, and it was really exciting for them to get their first reparations payment from me. I like that. Collecting from white people payments for black people. What do you think of that? Do you want one? Come here. Come here. There's your first reparations payment for slavery. Yeah.
You giving money to everybody?
I'm giving money to you, yeah.
What's the catch?
There's no catch.
Yeah. It's always a catch. I ain't giving money for nothing.
Your ancestors worked hard for that. You should get some money. Well, I'm collecting some reparations payments, and here, I can make a payment to you.
For what?
For the work of our ancestors. No, but that's what I'm doing. I'm collecting it from white people, and I'm giving it to black people. There you go. What do you think of that?
Yeah. What to do with mine?
I would put it in an account that bears interest.
Good idea, too.
I'm just getting the work done, you know what I mean? Getting the job done. Don't spend it all in one place.
Handhandling is not big business. Most people who paid gave a dollar or whatever change they had in their pocket. Every day I do it, I am so humbled, so thankful I don't have to pay for my meals this way. My first day in Portland, I made $16.32. In each city after that, I made between $10 and $15. After four cities, I collected and reallocated about $75 in reparations.
I'm collecting reparations.
Get some of my money back.
You don't have to pay.
I don't have any black power.
There you go.
For what?
Slavery.
Oh.
No, it's a reparation. Look, this Zachary here made the payment to me, and I'm giving it to you.
Thank you, Zachary.
From a white American to a black American.
When I sit on the street, my head is right at the level where people carry a shopping bag.
Did you all want to pay some reparations today? Reparations? You can pay right here. Did you guys want to pay some reparations today? Or you could shop?
My first day, a woman screamed at me that I was uneducated. Another man told me I wasn't living in reality. All that white rage can be a lot to handle.
If you want reparations or you want something to do with slavery, don't sit on the side of the street and bum money. It's dumb.
She and her group should, you know, go to work to better themselves as opposed to trying to get reparations for past deeds to their people.
I know they were mistreated and maybe they deserve something, but to sit there and beg for it on the street corner, not too classy.
I think it's my personal responsibility to repair people for things that were inflicted upon them a couple of centuries ago.
How can you fix that injustice? You can't with money or anything else.
It's a completely irresponsible idea. We corrected the wrongs as we went along. It's un-American, it's unconstitutional, and it's dead wrong.
You want to pay some reparations?
People always ask me if my work has a sense of hope. I respond that I'm just engaging reality, offering real chances for dialogue. One of these moments happened in Harlem. A black man complained to me about white people and their lack of respect. Then a white woman came up and paid $2 in reparations. He was shocked.
That's the first time I've actually heard somebody say that.
It's true, though.
He said he'd never heard a white person care about black people. He continued to listen, and eventually he asked her for a hug. The two embraced as I watched from the sidewalk below.
He says we can't all get along.
Do you all want to pay some reparations today?
Collecting reparations, you can pay right here.
You want to pay some reparations? Hey folks, it's time to pay some reparations. You can pay right here.
Damali Ayo produced this story about her street performance as a panhandler with Dime Roberts. I'm Kurt Anderson with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, and we are talking about the street and various kinds of art about it, and that happens there. Joel, what was your reaction to that work?
Well, in a way, it was like a performance piece. You know, she's
exactly what it was. Yeah.
She's really locked onto something. It's a very bold initiative to strike there, a kind of consciousness-raising thing. And although you can see from her $75, it's not terribly effective, for the few people who paused for a moment to give something and to take in the large injustice and insult that's historically, you know, ours, it may be effective in that way. And if she has the courage to continue to do this from city to city, she's going to get something from this. And how it affects her performance or her life and what she does with it is something we should hope to see.
Well, it's interesting, since reparations, all of their virtues and demerits aside, are a symbolic act, as I understand it. And here's a sort of symbolic version of a symbolic act.
Well, she's sitting on the ground. She's made herself, she's humbled herself. She's not aggressive. There was a gentleness to it there, and I could even hear a little uncertainty on her part, except when she spoke. Then she was quite present and strong. It would certainly catch my attention on the street, because she's not just a panhandler, right? She's somebody who's trying to panhandle your consciousness into forming, and that's kind of lovely.
Well, it also reminds me the degree to which street life at its best is like the greatest theater in the world. And the joy of people watching in the street has been, again, from the middle of the 19th century, people began to see the street as a theatrical experience.
Yeah, but we're on stage with the actors. It's not that just we watch them. We are performing with them, or we can be drawn into the performance right away. And part of being swept away on the street is the pleasure of the street. You know, the other day there was a parade. It was the Greek parade two Sundays ago or something like that. And I was walking by, and I just sort of slipped through the barrier and went out onto the street into the parade and walked along photographing and watching but participating. And, you know, it was uplifting. That's all I can say. There was just all that good energy, all those kids who had been polished up by their parents, and they came out. The Greek neighborhoods poured their heart into this. And there was that unity that a subculture in a big city has. And I just thought to myself, this is America. This is the experiment of America.
Now, you mentioned how in certain cities you go to, and we all know them, and not just downtowns, but suburbs as well, where streets exist, and sometimes they're well manicured and in some sense beautiful, but they're dead. They're devoid of life. It's interesting to me, as I've followed urban planning debates over the last 25 years or so, how there is a whole school that is trying to rediscover how to build streets physically that actually engender life, that are good media for growing that, in the way that Jane Jacobs talked about 40 years ago. Do you have a sense of what makes what physical aspects of the way sidewalks are built, or how wide streets are, or whether there are trees or not, all those things that engender a kind of vibrant street culture?
I do, actually. I'm New York is a great model for it. I believe that the axis of the streets are very important. How they lay north, south, east, west, in relative to the sun's motion during the year, promotes a kind of activity on the street. I was appalled by Atlanta's grid. It was laid out in such a way, it's a sunny southern city, and its axis was such that it was almost always in shadow on the main streets in the older part of the downtown area. It was a kind of street you didn't want to be on. And the buildings were built in such a way that there was almost no store frontage. The skyscrapers were rooted in the ground. They went straight up, it seemed, and because they were underground malls or interior malls. So there was little to draw you to window shop on the street. And so one's passage along the street front is brisk, because you want to get some place. But the street in New York is the place. And I think one has to keep that in mind when you're building new environments or new streets, that you want it to have a kind of variation and asymmetry.
Joel Meyerowitz, thank you very much for joining me today.
Kurt, this has been so much fun.
My guest has been the photographer Joel Meyerowitz. He's the author of several books, including Bystander, A History of Street Photography, Cape Light, and Tuscany, Inside the Light. You can find out more about him and the other stories you heard today at studio360.org.
Watching the world go by, under a sunny sky, strolling around the park on Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon.
Oh, how the moments fly. Watching the world.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Lital Mawad,
Michelle Siegel,
David Krasnow,
Ave Carrillo,
Jonathan Mitchell,
Benjamin Shaw,
Eric Malinsky.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum. The music from Cape Town was recorded by Jake Warga. The music from Berkeley by Peter Crimmins. And our piece on the poet Stuart Dybeck was produced by Edward Lifson. Our piece on the Living Flag was produced by Dime Roberts and Damali Ayo with funding by HearingVoices.com through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional assistance by Michael Johnson and Katrin Einhorn. For more information about that piece, you can visit our website, studio360.org.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, accelerating entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org. Additional support for Studio 360 is provided by Volkswagen of America and the Phaeton, a new kind of luxury car from Volkswagen. More information about the Phaeton's all-wheel drive system or its 335-horsepower V8 engine can be found at VW.com. And by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, now celebrating 10 years online, offering almost 2 million used, new, and out-of-print titles on the web at Powell's.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Do you mean that I can never go into the bathroom?
And that's right.
We loved Lucy and Ricky because of their shtick.
No more doing whatever it is you do to your hair.
Well, no more food for you.
But we also loved knowing that they were married in real life.
Come back in a couple of weeks, Ethel. We'll still be here. A starving Cuban and a dirty brunette.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Creative couples who work together. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.